This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 136. There isn't much corn in Oklahoma. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Matt Miller. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including full details of the TNG Season 6 and Chain of Command Blu-ray extras, new additions to Star Trek Las Vegas, some advice from Will Wheaton, and some exciting news about Trek FM and iTunes. Then in the feature, we're joined by Larry Nemechek and Jose Munoz to discuss the Enterprise pilot, Broken Bow. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Matt. It's great to have you back with me here on The Ready Room. It has been... I was shocked, actually. I looked to see when was the last time Matt Miller was on the show. And I think it was episode 100 when we had 11 people on the show for the big anniversary broadcast for The Ready Room.
That's right. Thanks very much, Chris, for having me back.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. How is everything going down there in Australia these days?
Yeah, really good. We're doing a bit of work on my website and the fan series that I'm working on, and that's done really well. Last weekend, we actually got up, I think I've worked out, it's about 70% of the first 10 episodes recorded. So that's exciting, and I'm looking at a visual aspect on that now, and I've got a couple of feelers out, so fingers crossed I'll have some info on that later on.
Yeah, that's very, very cool. So we'll have to find out more about that. And, you know, actually, I do a show now about independent productions, fan series and all. It's called Continuing Mission. So I'm going to have to get you on there and like really talk about this and see what you've got going on.
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic.
So let's go ahead and jump into the news here because our feature is quite long today. We're going to be joined by Larry Nemechek and Jose Munoz to talk about Broken Bow, behind the scenes, creating Enterprise and all that. But of course, Enterprise would have never existed if The Next Generation hadn't been such an amazing success when it was on. And we've been getting the Blu-ray sets. I've got all the ones that have been released so far, the first five seasons, over here on my shelf. Season 6 is going to be coming out finally in June. You know, it's a longer gap this time between seasons than we've been getting, but we finally have from CBS details on everything that's going to be included on the Season 6 Blu-rays, and also on that feature-length Chain of Command Blu-rays.
I'm looking forward to this. It's going to be absolutely fantastic. I just love what they're doing with the Blu-ray, with the remastering, and especially next-gen as opposed to the original series, because everything comes back from the camera negative, even all the exteriors and all that sort of jazz. So it's a lot more like... that it's just one show and it's been produced now, unlike the original series where they had to recreate the CGI elements, and it just sort of, to me, detracts away from the storytelling. It's sort of that's really cool, and then you're back into it like, oh, that's right, this is happening. Whereas Next Gen, it's just this beautiful flow, HD, gorgeous colors.
Right. Yeah. I don't mind what they did on TOS. I think it was a smart move to make those stories accessible to a modern audience that didn't grow up with it. But I'm like you, I love what they're doing with TNG because we're seeing the attention to detail that the creative team put into the work that we never saw before. And, you know, knowing that that was there from the beginning and knowing that they did all that, even when you wouldn't be able to see it in standard definition on television, is really, really impressive. So, Matt, tell us what we can expect on the Season 6 Blu-ray sets here.
Well, Chris, it looks like we've got some deleted scenes are going to be coming for a few episodes. Time's Arrow Part 2, True Q, Ship in a Bottle, Face of the Enemy, and various other ones. Looks like there's also going to be some audio commentaries as well with Ronald T. Moore and the wonderful Mike and Denise Okuda on a couple of episodes as well. Not forgetting James L. Conway and Jonathan West on episode Frame of Mind as well. So I'm really looking forward to those. I think that's a new part of the DVD collections. I don't think we've had audio commentaries previously.
No, we haven't. In fact, the stuff that we're covering today in this story is just the new stuff, because the stuff that was on the DVD sets in the past, that's going to be there too. But this is all the new stuff. Now, I've really, really been enjoying the audio commentaries on all these episodes, Enterprise episodes as well, and those Blu-rays. I was a little disappointed here that we're only going to be getting audio commentaries for Relics, Tapestry, and Frame of Mind, because I want to have commentaries for every single episode, even though I know logistically that's probably not a realistic expectation as a fan, you know, because it does cost money for the studios to produce these commentaries, plus it takes a lot of time as well. But how do you feel about the audio commentaries?
I love them. I think that it's another way of watching the show. And you go through one recently that I did was the Stargate SG-1 series. They've got audio commentaries for all of their episodes, and it's another way of watching that episode. You see the actual episode that was written and created and the way that was done. And then you go back and watch it again and you listen to the behind the scenes stories. And Stargate was really cool because on some of them, they described, for me as a filmmaker, they described some of the ways that they did some of the shots and the way they did things and all that sort of jazz. And also little anecdotes from the set and all that sort of jazz, which is really cool. You don't really know about that. And you get that and you hear it from the actors themselves and the creative people and that. That's really cool.
It really is. And that's sort of what you do too. I mean, with Trek Zone, you go to the cons, you actually do video interviews with lot of the actors that come. And so you get to ask these questions too and get those little behind the scenes tidbits.
Yeah, and it's the best part of the job, I think, is that not only do we get to meet them, and like last weekend in Oz Comic Con in Perth, actually sitting down with them and we've got, I mean, it's quite a little bit rushed. We got 20 minutes with them, but that's still a long time and a lot more than, say, a fan would get lining up in the queue. And right. I'm not saying everyone needs to go out and build their own Star Trek website, because then it would be really, really even more hectic. But it's, it's really cool. And you hear that and you develop this rapport one-on-one, and it's something that I'm still learning how to do. And each interview I do is getting better and better with just me getting comfortable with sitting down with these people that, oh my gosh, I watched them for so long and in repeats and original runs of the shows. And, but they're just people. And that's the fantastic thing. And our visitor was, she was lovely, just sat down and it was just, oh, we're just having a conversation. We could almost be just down at the coffee shop having a coffee and not being in a media interview. That's how fantastic it is.
Yeah. Well, it's great that these people also, not just actors, because they've been doing some, especially on the Enterprise Blu-rays, but the creatives behind it too will sit down and talk about these things for all the fans too, you know, who can't make it to the conventions, and that we're getting those audio commentaries on here as well. Another thing that they've been doing with these sit down, you know, conversations like that that have been great are these documentaries, and season 6 TNG is going to have one of those as well, called Beyond the 5-Year Mission: The Evolution of Star Trek: The Next Generation. So, you know, going from, I would assume by the name, going from the original series, because that's the 5-year mission, to the Next Generation. It's a 3-parter. Part 1, the lithosphere. Part 2, the biosphere. Part 3, the noosphere. So it doesn't really give me too much of an idea of what we're going to be getting in terms of content in those. But I'm sure it'll all make sense when we get it down there. Now, the feature-length episodes, this is also going to happen again with Season 6, and the one they've chosen is Chain of Command. Interesting for me, Matt, is that in Japan, we've gotten everything so far. You know, we've gotten the best of both worlds. We've gotten Redemption. We've gotten Unification. Chain of Command, it has been announced, will not be released in Japan. And I don't know if it's because of the subject matter or what the reason is. I think that's probably the reason. Are you going to be getting it in Australia?
I'm waiting to hear back from my contacts at Paramount. They sort of like to keep things a little close to their chest, and I get the information from the retailers rather than Paramount. They seem to be a little bit more reliable. I really hope so. We've gotten the same as everyone else in the past with those features, and I really hope that we get arguably one of the best TNG episodes in its own right and its own packaging.
Well, even if you don't, you'll be able to order it from the US, because one of the great things about Blu-rays is that they're region free. Most Blu-ray players will play discs from anywhere, which is great, because that's actually where I get my discs, is I order them from the States. Because another thing I wanted to ask you actually about these box sets here, the price is kind of high in the States anyway. I think it's $129 retail, but usually if you get them on release day, yeah, they're like $70 range probably. Now in Japan, they're like 25,000 yen, so they're like close to $300, $250, $300 range, depending on the exchange rate. So I just get them from the States. But how are these things being priced in Australia?
They're around $40 to $50 Australian at the moment. And I've actually done a really great deal, shameless plug here, JB Hi-Fi are a retailer here, and they've been really good to me, that they'll give me a really good discount price because I'm using them for the website, for trekzone.org. So that's been really good. But yeah, having said they're giving me a good price, it's the retail price minus a little bit of their markup. So they're still making money off it. Obviously, you don't want to be getting things for free. Well, I'd love to get things for free, but unfortunately, sometimes you just can't work these things out. It's quite a moneymaker, I think. When 4K comes out and becomes a consumer standard, then everything will be re-released in 4K just to keep those money cogs turning. Because I just have to look at my bookcase over there and all of the VHSs, and then all of the DVDs, and now all of the Blu-rays.
That's what my wife told me. She said, when these come out on another format, you're going to want to buy them again, aren't you? But I don't know. I mean, we have 4K televisions in Japan. And like, if you go in the stores, there's 4K TVs all over the place. And there have been now for a good year or more, year and a half or even 2 years. But I don't know. The quality difference is just, I think I'm happy with the Blu-rays. I don't know if I would go for 4K. I don't know if they could improve on them between Blu-ray and 4K to make it worth it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that there's really only that step that you can make, because 4K is the next step. There really is 35mm film, which has been the standard ever since the beginning. And 35mm film is comparable, or is a little bit better than HD. So HD is really the furthest you can go without having to recreate everything again, just like the original series, and you know, with those recreated CGI, that's sort of what we'd be getting again with 4K. So I agree. I think we're at the end. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but this is as far as I think the technology can bring Star Trek to us.
Yeah.
I'd love widescreen Star Trek though.
Except for the next series that comes out, which maybe will be shot in 4K.
And let's hope it's not in the alternate universe.
Okay, well, so Chain of Command Blu-rays, last point here on this story, will include an audio commentary with Ronnie Cox, Jonathan West, and Mike and Denise Okuda. It will include deleted scenes, and then they'll have the episodic promos. So there's also, I should say, a feature on there as well called The Privilege of Rank Making Chain of Command. So That's definitely worth the price. You know, these discs are, I think they're retailing for about $20. Definitely worth the price just to get those extras.
It's a really interesting choice of commentators for that episode. I mean, Ronnie Cox obviously was our fill-in captain and that guy that grated against the whole team. But to bring him back, just this once-off special guest star, to bring him back for an audio commentary for a Blu-ray release is interesting and almost unheard of. You know, normally it's the main cast that get a berth in the commentary booth.
Right.
But I'm looking forward to it.
But I like it because you get to hear, that's information that you're rarely going to get to hear, you know, his thoughts on it. So that's excellent. I wish they would actually do that more often with these. Mm. So we'll put a link in the show notes for more info on this if you want to see it and you want to watch the trailers over at Trek Corps. And let's go on to the next story, Matt. And this is about Star Trek Las Vegas. It's hard to believe that Star Trek Las Vegas is coming up in just a few months now. I mean, we're into April. And this is going to happen July 31st through August 3rd at the Rio in Las Vegas. And as you would expect, they've got a huge all-star cast lined up of guests for the convention. We've talked about them here on the show in the past. They've added a couple of new people, that, and one in particular that I would just love to sit down with and share stories with. We've got Peter Weller, who of course played Paxton in Demons and Terra Prime on Enterprise, and more recently Admiral Marcus in Star Trek Into Darkness. We've got Sherry Jackson, who is the android Andrea from What Are Little Girls Made Of, as well as Lee Ehrenberg, who played a lot of characters on Star Trek. He played Growl the Ferengi in The Negus, Growl the Tellarite in Babel 1. So I think he may be the only person to ever play two characters of two different races that have the same name. He also played Prak in Force of Nature, Bok the Ferengi in Bloodlines, and Pelk, the mainline crew member, in Juggernaut. So a lot of Ferengi in there, actually.
Yeah.
But Matt, the person that I would love to sit down, have a drink with, and just chat away with is Mark Alan Shepard, because he played Morn on Deep Space Nine.
Yep. I hear that they're going to give him a panel but no microphone. But
he's just sitting
agree.
Up there on a stool. He's just sitting there for, you know, an hour. You just look at him. He just looks at you.
And do you know what's really funny, Chris? I reckon Star Trek fans coming to the convention would sit there in a theater and just watch that for an hour.
Probably
and
they would.
No questions were needed. That's how crazy some of us are. But no, I agree. And I'm actually trying to get to Star Trek Las Vegas this year. I'm trying to organize a US trip for the site because I have an inexhaustible supply of money. It's what I like to believe. My credit card tells me another thing.
Right?
Yeah, the credit cards, they just tend to sit over there and no, I'll just pay them later. But just the amount of guests that are coming to Vegas, Avery Brooks, Jonathan Frakes, Brent Spiner, Michael Dorn, Marina Sirtis, LeVar Burton, all of those people, William Shatner, Bob O'Reilly, J.G. Hertzler, Anthony Montgomery, Cole Meany.
Yeah, there's just the list so goes many. On. The list goes on and on and on and on and on.
And in fact, I did get media passes to last year's Vegas convention, but the way I talked myself out of it, aside from having no money, was that there's a lot of people here, a lot of great guests that I'd love to have a chat with, and you just run out of time doing it. So it's better to go to the little conventions and get them as they come along.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, Vegas is still Vegas, and I've never been, so.
Well, maybe you'll get there. I'm hoping to get there myself this year. I don't know if I'll be able to make it either, because I mean, for both of us, you know, we live over here in Asia, and it's hard to make that trip. It's a long and expensive trip for us. But if we can get over there, a just really amazing panel. And the thing is, they're going to add more and more people before we finally get to July 31st.
That's right. And I know that two regular Trek FM podcasters will also be there as well. Larry Nemechek and Doug Drexler, I believe, are slated to appear, which will be very exciting. And it'll certainly be, because I've had a chat with both of those guys burning up the satellite time, but would love to sit down and just have a chat with them and live out the dream that Seth MacFarlane did. I think it was on the season 2 Blu-ray, and sat down with the writers and had a writers roundtable discussion. That was just fantastic. And that's something I'd love to do for the site.
That is fantastic, yeah.
And for Trek FM, of course.
Oh, excellent. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to Star Trek Las Vegas. Even if I'm not able to make it, we will definitely have Trek FM people there. And hopefully you'll be there as well, Matt, to do that. And we'll keep you up to date on who is being added as we go along. So, speaking of conventions, Matt, this is a video. Next story here is a video that... It's actually from about a year ago at Denver Comic Con, but it went viral on YouTube over the past week, and it's Will Wheaton answering a child's question about being a nerd and about being picked on. The question was, when you were a kid, were you called a nerd? And if so, how did you deal with it? And it would have been easy for Will Wheaton to say something like, you know, yeah, that happened to me as well. You just have to remember that kids are mean to each other and just try not to take it personally and remember to love what you love, you know, and then go on to the next question. But instead, Will Wheaton gave a really, really lengthy and very, very thoughtful response, very heartfelt response to this child. And I was just blown away by it. And I wanted to mention it here on the show and ask you if you saw it. And then I also wanted to ask you, you know, if what did you have this experience also in Australia, you know, growing up as a kid and being interested in Star Trek and science fiction and things like that?
Yeah, I saw it this morning and it was just fantastic that, and it goes again to what I've said and what I keep saying when people ask me, you know, that these actors are just people and they went through similar sorts of things that we did. And hey, we all grew up and we all went to school and had problems with bullies. And I agree with Will. He said it in the video, life does get better. And it does. But in answer to your question, yes, I guess more so I was a bit of a loner in high school and I kept to myself and I did the library and the books and everything else. But I was sort of away from the bully aspect. I was never actually picked on. I think I actually got through schooling relatively unscathed. But towards the end of my schooling there, when I moved, so I moved schools for year 11 and I found a group of friends that accepted me for who I was. And I think that was the best thing for me in that I hung around with those people and associated with them. And they weren't necessarily into sci-fi and Star Trek and everything else, but they were, for lack of a better word, they were geeks. They loved their computers and we'd spend weekends pulling apart computers and rebuilding them. And they were the people that I hung out with. I was very fortunate that there was a group like that, with me at school. And yeah, so I think that's the, if I ever get asked, I think that's the best advice I can give. Try and find people with similar interests, not necessarily the same. And Will said it as well, that find a common connection. And it may not necessarily be that you love the same thing, but you love something just as much as someone else. And I know he mentioned sport. But I mean, it may be that they love Doctor Who and you love Star Trek, or right, they love footy. And, you know, coming back to that sport, is there's a common element amongst, you know, many humans, that, and you find that common ground and you get interested in that. And that's how it develops. I mean, unfortunately, I haven't kept in contact with very many of my high school friends. I mean, we're friends on Facebook, and I think I missed the 10-year reunion invite, but, or maybe I wasn't invited at all. But hey, you know, but it doesn't really matter. And life has continued on, and I've developed new friends and new colleagues like yourself, Chris. I mean, you're over there in Japan, but we share this common interest of Star Trek and running websites and podcasting and talking about how we feel about the show. And it's really cool that people want to listen to that.
Yeah, yeah. What he said, like you're saying there, that remember that whatever the other person is interested in, and sports is a great example, because like my experience in school was often that I was picked on, and not so much for science fiction, but because I was in the band. You know, I was a musician. I don't know if I can call myself a musician when I was in school, but I did become a musician and played professionally after that. So it was something that I was really, really, really dedicated to. And I was picked on for that, the way that people are often maybe picked on these days for being into science fiction. And it was often athletes who were picking on us because of that. And like Will was telling them, you know, that whatever it is that person likes, they care about it just as much as you care about your science fiction or whatever it is. And so remember that. And like you said, that's where you find that common ground with people. And also, as you mentioned, he said, just remember that it gets better as you get older. So that's, I guess, a universal thing. You know, the experiences that you shared there are something I think we have all experienced. And I was really impressed with, you know, people make fun of Wesley Crusher and people make fun of Wil Wheaton over the years and all. But I have to say that I've been really impressed with Wil Wheaton in recent years, especially as he's gained a more prominent exposure through Twitter, through being on The Big Bang Theory and other places. And I really appreciate him taking the time to answer that question for the child who asked it there.
Yeah, and I think that just very quickly, that I think that he is the number one person that I want to meet. Even more, I mean, Bill Shatner's up the top, fairly high, yeah. But Will purely because he's Captain Kirk, but Wil Wheaton, for everything that he's done, as you said, you know, he's there on The Big Bang Theory and he's on Twitter and he's giving fans these answers and yeah, not shirking them off and just saying, yep, nah, it'll get better. It's detailing it and getting in there and trying to help that person out. And I'd like to think that answer really, really spoke to her. And she took it away last year because obviously it was shot at last year's DenverCon. But, she took that away and has tried to take his advice, I guess, and it'd be really fascinating to know how she's getting on many months later.
So we'll put a link in the show notes to the video if you haven't seen it yet. I do encourage you to go to watch it because it's really great. And I think it's very much in the spirit of what Star Trek is in the first place, which is diversity and, you know, accepting people who are different and respecting what everyone else believes in and is interested in. Mm. Well, Matt, we have one last thing in news today, and this is actually about us, about Trek FM. And we've had a really exciting development with Apple. And everyone knows that we put our podcasts into iTunes, and we do enhanced podcasts as well. If you happen to be streaming this or you happen to be downloading an MP3 file, our enhanced podcasts have chapters and links and artwork that changes throughout in them as well. And we really love the platform that Apple and iTunes gives us to distribute our content to everyone. And I'm very pleased to announce that working with Apple, we have been given our own new home inside the iTunes store. It's a really beautiful place now. If you go to Trek FM in iTunes, you will be able to reach our new artist page, which is actually more like an artist site. We've currently got 19 pages inside iTunes. We have a main page, and we also, down the sidebar, we have categorized our content, shows by series, things that we talk about beyond the screen, because of course here on the network, we talk about books and comics, and we talk about music, and we talk about creatives from Star Trek and the work that they do beyond Star Trek, which is what Mike and Max talk about on Commentary Trek Stars. We talk about science and Star Trek Online and news and all kinds of things. And we have it all broken down for you now in the iTunes store. And if you click through those, you'll get to pages where you get just the shows that deal with those topics. And some of the features that you can expect, you can easily get to our top episodes. You can find special themes that we put together. At the moment, we have interviews with Star Trek creators and actors, which is a collection of episodes from various different shows on the network where we've interviewed people like Brandon Braga, Doug Drexler, Armin Shimmerman, Anthony Montgomery, Robbie Duncan McNeil. And we have our series-focused shows as well. We have fan series and independent productions where you can easily find our discussions with the people from Star Trek Continues, of course, with Larry, with Chris White, with Chuck Huber, with Todd Haberkorn, also Alec Peters, Richard Hatch from Star Trek Axanar, and also, in honor of Larry joining us today, I've actually put there in our iTunes section Behind the Scenes with Larry Nemechek, and I've collected a lot of the episodes that Larry has been on with us in the past to talk about behind the scenes of various Star Trek episodes. Larry's been on a lot of episodes of The Ready Room in particular, but actually all of our different shows, and we want to make it easy for you to find those as well. And we've got our interviews with the authors as well from the Star Trek literary universe. They're organized for you as well. So check this out. We really, really appreciate Apple extending this special invitation to us. This is something that they do for a few key providers. And it's really thanks to all of you guys who are listening that we now have this home in iTunes, because you have made our shows extremely popular. You've helped us bring great content that Apple recognized. And as a result, we now have this beautiful home. So I encourage everyone to go check that out. And thank you so much for your support of us over the past 3.5-4 years that we've been doing Trek FM. And I can't wait to bring you more exciting things in the near future. All right, Matt. Well, before we jump into the feature with Larry and Jose, we'd like to tell everyone about our sponsor for today's show, and that is Audible.com. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks online, with more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and new titles coming every week. They have new releases, of course. They have classics. They have current bestsellers. They have lots of Star Trek books on there as well, some of the most famous ones like Prime Directive, Federation, and Spock's World. And what we like to do every week is to recommend a book for you. And the book I want to recommend this week is Star Trek: The Klingon Way, A Warrior's Guide. And one reason I chose this one today, Matt, is that this is the first time that we have recorded since April Fool's Day, April 1st. And StarTrek.com, they pulled one over on everyone with Rosetta Stone, the very popular language learning platform. And it was Rosetta Stone Klingon. And they went so far as to actually have Michael Dorn holding the Rosetta Stone box. Now, I'm not sure if it was a Photoshopped deal or they actually got Michael Dorn to hold the box. Although I do know that you can go to, I believe, ThinkGeek and buy the packaging for the Rosetta Stone Klingon edition.
Oh, fantastic.
So it actually, that packaging does exist.
That's awesome.
So how do you feel about Klingons real quick, Matt? Do you love them so much that you've gone and you've explored things like Mark O'Kran's Klingon Dictionary, the Klingon Way, A Warrior's Guide here, which is also by Mark O'Kran, or our friend Keith DeCandido has the Klingon Art of War, which will be coming out next month on May 6th, I believe.
I've tried to dabble in some Klingon drinking songs. hasn't always ended so well, but I have been heavily inebriated anyway, and I think they're fantastic. But I'm loving the look of this book, and I'm certainly going to check it out because I'd love to get into a bit more of my Klingon nature with the fan series. I've been delving into the Romulans, but I'd like to bring it back to the good old you know where you stand with a Klingon, you know. So that's want to bring it back to the Klingons, and I think that the Klingon way is the way to do that. To delve into our warrior friends.
Okay, so I have an idea now. If you're doing Klingon drinking songs on Literary Treks, Matthew Rushing, my co-host there, he likes to sing. He sings all the time on that show. I think we need to get you and Matthew together. You guys can sing. It'll be a new group, Trek FM group, The Mats. We can put albums out. He's already working on his album called This One's for the Cover, where he sings his different variations of our Judge a Book by Its Cover theme. And I think you guys would be great together.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm not sure if you remember, but Matt Rushing is actually the reason I had to change my Twitter handle.
Oh, that's
to
right.
Mirror Matt. Yeah. To Mirror Matt. That's still there. That's still happening.
That is right. All right. So everyone, if you would like to get Star Trek The Klingon Way, A Warrior's Guide, the audio version is narrated by Michael Dorn and Roxanne Dawson. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get this book absolutely free just for trying Audible. And the way you do that is to go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up, choose this book or any book you want. And if after the trial you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you get to keep this book. That's yours. But by supporting Audible, you'll be helping us keep the Ready Room coming to you every week. So again, go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and give Audible a try. If you love podcasts, you're absolutely going to love audiobooks. And we really thank Audible for their support of the Ready Room and Trek FM. In 2001, Star Trek landed with great fanfare in a cornfield in Oklahoma. It was the launch of Enterprise, as the series was known for its first two seasons, and the pilot episode Broken Bow was well received. Over the years, perceptions of Enterprise have changed more than once, and today we're going to talk about the pilot episode and some of the behind-the-scenes activities surrounding it with the help of one of the Oklahoma locals, Larry Nemechek. Larry, welcome back to the Ready Room.
Boomer Sooner, Chris! How about right. That sugar bowl? Oh, sorry. Don't mention the war!
You just had to bring that up, didn't you? Yeah, some people may think, Larry, that I had you on the show, you know, because you're Dr. Trek and you know all the Star Trek stuff, but I was just looking for someone, you know, who could give us the true lowdown on Oklahoma and Broken Bow.
Yes, because I'll tell you about that. Within a year, I had never been down, because in the far corner of the state, in the timber country of Oklahoma, which blows your mind, I know. And I actually went down there about a year after the pilot came out, just to kind of take my own pictures and talk to people and everything. So anyway, that was a hoot. I actually have been to Broken Bow once.
Wow.
So it is a real place.
It is a
Yeah. Well, we can let's jump in and we can talk about that in a minute. But yeah,
talk about that in a minute. Also joining us from the Zero Room podcast and from the television team, the Star Trek television studio team itself. Back on the Ready Room for the first time in a long time is Jose Munoz. Hello, Jose.
Hey, hello. How are you guys doing?
Hey. Doing well. Glad to have you back.
So from zero to ready?
Yes, from zero to ready. I can do that.
To ready. From the Zero Room to the Ready Room.
There you go.
That's right. All right, well, let's jump into this here. So Larry, you're telling us about Oklahoma, and one of the first things I want to talk about are the behind-the-scenes rumblings of the early days of development of Enterprise and of Broken Bow. And one of those little tidbits there is the fact that they decided to set the scene with the Klingon crash landing in Oklahoma. And it's actually a real place, as you said, Broken Bow.
Well, okay, and I don't want to get too much ahead of this because Jose was there was carrying memos around the first rumblings. But what I went back – okay, I have a moment – we're kind of skipping ahead a little bit. But after it aired, I finally cornered Brannon, and I said, so did you put this in Oklahoma, like, to get back at me or something, or it was funny? Because I just thought it was hysterical. I just thought it was hysterical that the newest, greatest – let's remember where we are. It's 2001. They'd been in development for a couple years. But this was the thing that all the eggs, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jose, this was like everybody was very conscious of the fact that this was the future of the franchise and the Berman era. And even Nemesis was being made, and I think there was a lot more emphasis and stress and pressure and responsibility and the old secrecy around any new Star Trek project. But it was much more intense around Enterprise than it was even around Nemesis. It was almost like Stuart Baird was running, you know, Nemesis into the ground. And no, I'm kidding. But I just remember being struck by that as the communicator editor and as someone who knew everybody and, you know, would try to talk to somebody I knew very well, like Mike Westmore or somebody, and go, oh, they're going to yell at us if we say anything we're not supposed to say. But you want to talk about Nemesis? Okay. It was just really strange. But there was a lot of pressure on Enterprise to be the bridge to the future for Star Trek. So later on, I caught Brandon real quick, and I said, Oklahoma, what's the deal? And he's like, I said, did you do that because, like, for Janet and me? And he's laughing because, No, not at all, not at all. I said, okay, well, it's like, what? And he says, well, Rick just liked the joke about there being a Klingon from Oklahoma. He just thought that was hysterical. Now, this is what Brandon told me. But apparently, they wanted the cornfield, right? And Brandon said he liked Broken Bow because it sounded Midwestern-y, and he thought it sounded like, you know, something gone astray. Not an intact bow, but a broken bow. And then the name Archer, Broken Bow, kind of fit all together. But they originally figured out that they were thinking Nebraska, Iowa, up there in corn country, right? And then they said, no, let's not have it be Iowa because that's like Kirkland, and that'll be repetitious of Kirk. So then according to Brandon telling me this at the time, he's like, Rick just thought a Klingon from Oklahoma was too funny a joke, and they just said it there. And so I said, okay. Well, I said, so you know that there's not really much corn around Broken Bow, Oklahoma. And his jaw fell off. And he's like, there really is a broken Oklahoma. And I was like, I know that the research that Kellum DeFord, what's her name that took over Kellum DeFord, I know they had to have told them that in a memo. But I said, yes, it's down in the timber country. It's not flat. It's not green. It's down almost Texas and Louisiana. It's in the very corner, southeast corner of the state. And it's all timber and lakes, which is really funny.
Yeah, but that's now. That's now. That's now. After many years of wars and God knows what, it's all flat in cornland now. Absolutely.
I did find there's like some flat farmland about 5 miles south of Broken Bow that was, you know, so. But you're absolutely right, Jose.
Okay,
that's the kind of thing that you get
then
into. So
this is like the Roswell incident then. You know, that didn't actually happen in Roswell. Roswell was the closest military base.
Correct.
That's what this is all about. There's just swaths of cornfields 5 miles south of Broken Bow.
Exactly.
When Khan swept through them in a fiery blaze, he leveled the land, and now it's nice and flat for corn.
So, Jose, what do you remember about this, you know, that was going on around, because you were Rick Berman's PA, you were around the...
Yeah,
What kind of whispers did you hear?
So it's a couple of things, I would say. I wanted to get back to Larry's point about kind of about the secrecy of the show and whatnot, and sort of the Rick Berman legacy and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if any of that was... I personally, having, you know, been there for a little bit, don't know if any of that stuff really impacted them. I think when you have to put on your fourth Star Trek show, with the same executive producer, and, you know, one of the guys that you've had around now for three Star Trek shows, even though Brandon wasn't there at the beginning, but still, I think there is pressure, and I think that there's a desire and a hunger to try to make something different that you haven't already made, because in spite of maybe the sort of the scene-setting change of Deep Space Nine, and then once Ira takes over that show, it really becomes its own sort of thing, very separate from any of the other shows. But Voyager and Next Generation are trotting the same kind of ground, and certainly... the network, which I want to make sure I get it right, it was UPN, right?
Right.
At the time, really want a Star Trek show, and to, you know, on their network, controlled by the network, in a way that had never been the case, and I also think that they wanted a safe show. They wanted to invest money in a show that they knew that the formula worked, that was going to attract a certain amount of eyeballs.
That's and the studio more so than Rick and Brannon, though.
I think that you do have Rick and Brannon saying, well, if we got to make this show, then let's try to do something really different with it. And I think that the meetings of commerce and creativity kind of clashed a bit. So what I'm trying to get back to is, I don't know if Rick was thinking so much about his legacy, and I don't want to put words in his mouth necessarily or whatever, but I never got that sentiment. I got the sentiment that they wanted to put on, as I feel that they always did, want to do sort of the best show they could put on, and not repeat themselves, but yet be familiar and be accessible to please, you know, the guys who are paying the bills and the studio and the network, while at the same time trying to, it's really hard to do everything that they're trying to do. And in development cycles now, where in just to talk about the way Hollywood works today, in June, after pilot season's done and all the shows have been picked up and everything like that, development executives, and it's kind of happening right now, but development executives will go out and they will start buying up writers, shows, pitches, all kinds of stuff, so that you can have your first draft done by December, so that you can have your pilot order sometime December, January, so that you can start getting prep, so that you can start shooting in March of next year. So that means that your development schedule is literally compressed into like 6 months, whereas Rick and Brandon had much longer than that to do this thing, because Deep Space Nine was ending, because they could see down the line that the pattern had been set for 7 years. So they almost had 2 years to work on this and try to do what they wanted to do. So I don't know. I don't know so much about his legacy, so much as I think that it's about them trying to do something very different and wanting to keep that close to the vest, because we're now reaching that time where there's a lot of the internet's becoming a much bigger thing. We're leaking a lot more stuff out, and I think they just wanted to play it a little closer. But what I can remember from those days is a lot of meetings, a lot of Rick and Brandon, a lot of hours in Rick's office, just talking, which is what you do when you're doing this kind of thing, is you sit there and you talk about character and you talk about story and you talk about what you want to do with the show. And I remember, you know, seeing notes, looking at stuff or putting stuff away. The one bit, and I was, because I was trying to be good about not looking at the notes, that I remember catching was, I want to say they wanted to call the new Enterprise like a dreadnought class or a dreadnought or something along those lines. So it had more of a hulking sound to it, mm-hmm. like a bigger kind of meteor ship. that's a completely different movie. So I remember kind of those days of, like I said, a lot of Rick and Brandon working, you know, sort of 2 or 3 hours a day, or even just an hour a day, you know, a lot of calls. Is Brandon coming over today? Like, does he have time? Cause I want to work on the show, and you know, that kind of thing. So, that's a lot of what I remember, you know, from those times. And then just shortly after I left, production on Nemesis started. So when the ball really got rolling on Nemesis and Enterprise, when casting and all that stuff was going on, I was gone. I was there for Insurrection. Mm-hmm. So, those were my days on that.
Sorry, I missed just a second of that. When you were talking about legacy, was that a response to something I said, or was that?
Yeah, you made a comment about how you thought because of all the secrecy and over Enterprise, that there might be some thought about to what Rick's legacy that Enterprise might be considered like an extension of Rick's legacy on Star Trek, I'm just saying that from my point of view, and I don't know what it was like, maybe hearing from different people or whatever, I never got that impression. I just got the impression that, you know, it was part of the reason why it was being held close to the vest, at least at my time there, which was at its nascency, really, was just because I really think they wanted to do something different. And I think that when we get into the episode and we start talking about the show.
Right.
I think you can see that there are lots of hints about how different they really wanted to make this show and where those compromises were made.
Right, right, right. Okay. I think you misunderstood me but no, I wasn't talking so much about legacy. I'm talking about actual pressure. Like, by that time, the ratings on Voyager had started to slip, and there was a lot of talk about things are getting tired and time to shake things up. And what I meant was the pressure that even more so, a next-gen movie is just another next-gen movie. But I meant this was like the future of the franchise or the future. I think they felt a lot of pressure that this had to be successful and breathe some fresh air and bring in new viewers and all that kind of pressure. So I don't know if I said legacy.
Well,
I
think it's been, I want to say that I don't know if we talked about it with Chris, maybe last time we were on, with Dave. I think it's been well documented that the network really wanted to make a Star Trek show, and they didn't necessarily need Rick to do it. But
you're right.
When it was put out there, he was put in a situation. He chose to take that on, because if you're going to make Star Trek, well, I mean, I'm already running the movie and the TV show. I might as well make the next one. You know, they could have just gone to somebody else. But so I don't like again. It's back to the thing where it's like, I think maybe there was pressure, like there was pressure in to make any show when you're employing people and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, sure.
But I don't know.
I mean, this is the pressure of this. This is the pressure of the successful.
And it's
not
one of those things where
I
don't know if
rookie.
Rick was ever the kind of guy to think about, I don't know, the franchise per se. You know what I mean? Like the way that when people, I just got back from seeing Captain America this morning.
Right.
And you hear people talk about Marvel comics or Marvel movies and DC movies and the franchise and that kind of thing. And that to me is more of a how maybe fans perceive that kind of thing. his pressure is to make, you know, a television show. You know what I mean? It's just, I agree with you that there was pressure.
Yeah. Well, all I'm talking about is he feels a lot of responsibility. It'd been, from 87 on. I'm just talking about paychecks. I'm talking about continuity. I'm talking about a lot of people had a good time working together, and he wanted to keep that going, and he had his professional
pride. And I would agree, with that entirely.
About pressure to keep going. And of course he's going to jump on and not have somebody else. I mean, there's a certain amount of creative, professional pride and ego going on here, and you don't blame him. Right. Anybody would be in the same way. So that's what I meant about that. And what struck me as somebody there was watching it was how we had a movie and a new series come up at the same time. And usually the movies are the creme de la creme. But I could just tell there was such an extra level, more so than Voyager and DS9 even, because all the shows are secretive. I mean, you're always secretive about a new show. You don't ever want to ruin your big splash and surprise. But it was just like – it was like the normal amount of surprise secrecy, but there was just like – it just felt like there was a lot of future writing on this.
I also feel like that
– you know, it's like we're not going to do two shows at one time again. They learned that lesson, you know, kind of a thing. So this is going to be it, and we put our – which I thought was a great, you know, the people that were griping about it being a prequel, I thought was crazy. But this is what I'd want to say.
I also got the impression with Rick that there was a sense of wanting to protect Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry's creation, Star Trek.
Oh, I absolutely.
That he had been guarding over the years, and so
right, totally.
In that sense, I think that when they said that they can get someone else if he doesn't want to do it, he felt like, well, I'll do it, you know, rather than just handing it over. Because, I mean, he knows how the business works, and he knows how, well, if the studio really wants the show, they're just going to throw something out there, and it may not actually be true to what Star Trek is supposed to be.
And to Rick's credit, he would always tell us, and they thought this, that doing these shows one after the other, which is whatever the network, or in the case of the syndicate, whatever, he wanted to rest a year or two. And he was always worried about making – his phrase was one too many trips to the well too soon, you know. So – and I do know also that part of that creative and realistic attempt to be fresh and know full well that you'd had a lot of the same people for a long time, and that leads to complacency, and that there was such a – once they decided on the format and now it turned into staffing the show – there was a huge, and Jose, I don't know if you remember this or not, if you were there through this part of it, but there was a huge break of huge concern about not just having everybody come on board. I mean, obviously your cast would be new, but all the behind the scenes people, everybody basically had to go and re-audition again. And there were some people in the staff that they didn't have come back. And they didn't, not that they were bad, it was a thing about having fresh blood, and there were some people that almost didn't and wound up, but you know, everybody basically had to reapply. And part of it wasn't so much that we think you're suddenly not good at what you do, but it was the whole thing about freshness. It's like shake up, you know, we've got to have a fresh everything on this, and it's got to permeate. And so you had like Vince Dedrick came in for Dennis Madelone at stunts, and they changed the prop. Alan Sims went out for Craig Brinkley, and everybody, Wes Moore and Dan Curry, and everybody had to, and Herman, everybody had to like show that they could do something fresh and be radically, not radically different, but that they wouldn't just rut out, you know, from what they'd been doing.
Well, and again, I think that goes back to what I was saying earlier about the how they really, I think they really wanted to do something different with the show, and then there was a budding of philosophies at work in making that work. And I do remember that, you know, some people didn't come back from Voyager and go sort of dovetail into Enterprise. And there was sort of a melding of people that worked on Deep Space and never couldn't find a job afterwards, but made their way into Enterprise and stuff like that. You know, that was there were guys that worked on that show from the first day of Next Generation to the last day of Enterprise, you know, and
there were like 18, 19, 20 people. They took a group picture at the end.
And it's a lifetime of work is what that is. So,
Well, let's talk a little bit about the launching of the show next. And Matt, so you can jump in here from the fan side. You have something interesting that we rarely get to talk about on the show here because most of us are, I'm in Japan, but you know, I grew up in the States. But you're in Australia. When did Enterprise premiere in Australia? Did it premiere in 2001, or was it later on?
I'm pretty sure back then it was really we were still behind, and because Australian television is February to November. Obviously, US TV is September to May. So I'm pretty sure back then it was February 2002. And Star Trek was always Tuesday night, late night slot, 11:30, straight after the late news on Channel 9. And it was home. And back then well, digital was relatively new, and there weren't multi-channels here in Australia. So the primary channels, 7, 9, 10, were it. And Channel 9 saw that there was the following for Star Trek, not enough to justify primetime showing, not enough to justify a primetime showing, but it was there, and it was 11:30 every Tuesday, and they faithfully followed the release order that the networks had in the US, albeit 6 months behind. And then towards the end of Enterprise, obviously the internet came in more and more of those legitimate ways of downloading shows that we don't endorse.
So you guys got it in a linear nature. You got Deep Space Nine and you got Voyager and you got Enterprise, because that's not how it is everywhere. I know in Japan it wasn't necessarily like that. You know, we would get the shows at different times. So what was the Australian fan reception? So people who were fans of Star Trek and they had been watching Voyager, when Enterprise rolled around, I mean, what was the take down there, down under, should I say?
I was still very, very new to trekzone.org, my website and all that sort of stuff. But I guess it really was very much the same as America. It was this new show. My personal feeling was, is this going to be good enough? In hindsight, I now look at it and go, well, maybe that really was franchise fatigue. And, you know, Nine was there, and there was a, what was it called? It was the Neutral Zone. And they were flying in VHS tapes from the US. And they were bringing them in, and they were doing a Friday night screening at Murdoch University. And they were charging $2 entry, but it was a weekly convention of Star Trek. And the theaters were full. They expanded to 2-3 theaters. But unfortunately, that was around season 7 of DS9, and Paramount put a stop to it. They actually shut them down and took them to court.
I was going to say, that was somebody fly by night doing it to meet demand. But it wasn't an official thing. So it's like, and so of course, immediately they shut down the unofficial thing, but then raced in with an official thing to fill the gap.
Oh, yes,
right?
Of course, Larry. Yes, that's what they did.
Yeah, right. Because they're so savvy to come in and go, oh, look at this demand. We'll figure out we have the right to shut you down, but we'll just fill it ourselves and make the money.
That's exactly right. There were 2-3 lecture theaters full. And they were just broadcasting what was broadcast. Like, it was off-air recording of UPN that they brought over. Yeah. And sure, that's highly illegal because people that are working hard for this aren't getting the royalties out of it. But there's the demand there, and you would think that maybe we'll do something like that. And even now, almost 15 years later, there's still nothing official, and I'm running like the biggest Star Trek fan site in Australia, and there's nothing official out of it. And Paramount going, oh, you're doing this. Oh, okay, well, come on down to the premieres and all that sort of stuff. It's just kind of like, there is the market still there, guys.
Yeah.
But getting into those movies is a topic for another discussion.
But yeah, a missed opportunity there by people not too clueless to, or they don't think they can get the official machinery and attorneys to all get in line and do it.
I was only, so, I'll just digress very quickly. I was only 10 at the time, but I do still remember a Friday 8:30 showing of the, in 95, of Voyager's pilot.
I thought you were going to say Broken Bow. Okay.
Oh, no, I'm not that young. But, you know, it was there at Friday at 8:30, and then we actually took a family vacation to America and saw it again in San Diego, I think it was. That was, I think, the only time that Australian television had Star Trek in primetime, aside from the movies, which now get a run on digital multi-channels, you know. But Enterprise, little old Enterprise, was just tucked away there, as everything else, down on Tuesday evenings at 11:30. It was good, though, because I was still in school at the time and I got to stay up because I had to record it for the family.
So all Australia always saw Star Trek at 11:30?
Absolutely, yep.
Okay. That's like Oklahoma City and Next Gen, but that's another story.
Okay. I actually, digressing just sometimes. A little bit again, I remember my first episode of Star Trek was Times Square, Next Gen's second season, and I had to peer out from behind my this little half wall we had in the house because it was deemed too scary by the parents at that time for the kids to see it. But that was my first introduction to Star Trek, and then it just flowed on to me, you know, being at 11:30 at night watching Enterprise.
I remember peering out like that also to see something on TV that my parents had deemed too scary, except it was Fantasy Island. And it was some episode with some like big snakes in it or something. So,
you know, the pilot of Fantasy Island is very dark and dramatic. It's like the most deadliest game. It's like the guy's really hunting another guy. And the pilot is like nothing like the series. It's Ricardo Montalban is the host, but he unleashes a guy hunting a guy. And it's very, the most deadly game, whatever it is. Anyway.
Most dangerous game.
Was one of the guys named Tusk?
Well, yeah. Yeah. But yeah. we should get into the actual episode. We should. I hope we can talk a little bit about how the Bible came down and what the plan was, and then how the real world casting and the real world developed.
Yeah, let's go ahead and jump into this topic. So, series Bible in reality.
I found the casting call. I knew I had it. I found the casting call. You want me to read through it real fast? Not read it. Read it. Here's our timeline. So Broken Bow airs actually in the fall. So it airs, premieres on a network all this on the fall, which is the first time that ever happened. There's only one of the series besides the original series that wasn't a mid-season and or syndication, right? So it's fall premiere, September 26th, the whole country on one day. So so it aired September 26th. It shot from May 14th to June 21st, first unit, okay? So May to June shooting. And so I didn't have an exact date when the casting call went out to all the agents, late February, early March. And at the time, we had these characters named a Captain Jackson Arthur and Sub-Commander T'Pau and Charlie Spike Tucker and Dr. Phlox and Lieutenant Joe Mayweather, Lieutenant Commander Malcolm Reed, Ensign Hoshi Sato, and Silic, and Admiral Forrest, and Admiral Leonard, and Commander Williams, and Soval. So, and then Toss. So right there, you can see the names are in flux. This happened on a lot of the shows. It's just fun to look back. I think there was a real Jackson Archer.
There was, yeah.
Couldn't use Jackson.
Yeah. There was one, right? If there's only one person with that name, you can't do it.
Right. Yeah. Or pay them or make a deal or something. Henry Janeway was told him later on that he would have loved, or Elizabeth Janeway, his wife, would have loved to have been Elizabeth, but that was after the fact. They just had to cast the damn thing first. So T'Pau was originally to be the younger version of old T'Pau in Amok Time until they realized they'd be paying Ted Sturgeon's estate, I guess, right? Jose, do you remember, have a clue on that?
I was not a part of that conversation, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's the actual answer.
That's what I'd always
say. That makes the best sense.
And somehow, and I can't remember the story on this, how it's Charles Tucker, but they were going to call him Charlie all the time, but how that went from being Charlie to Trip, and his nickname being Trip as in the third, you know, Charles Trip Tucker the third, or Charles Tucker the third. But why they got away from his I've forgotten why they didn't want his nickname to be Spike after
there
all.
There was a character on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh, that's right.
Named
I didn't
Spike,
know that. Yes.
And so they had to change that.
Yeah. Joe Mayweather became Travis. Maybe that was a name thing. And that's really kind of thing. But again, it's, you know, that. And then I still love the fact that the three big wigs in the scene with Klang and with Phlox, when you see them, they did get sentimental on this. And for Brandon Rick to always be criticized as having no clue about the original series and then getting defensive about it and say, yes, we do. So like Admiral Forrest, you know, Forrest and Admiral Leonard and Commander Williams are all named for William and Leonard and DeForest Kelly. Mm-hmm. You knew that, right? Okay.
Yeah.
With modifications. But what's odd is that they gave, I'll never forget this moment, they gave them all first names in the script, but they're not called that way. And Admiral Forrest's first name is Maxwell in the script, but he's never addressed us that way for a long, long, long time. And I just remember this funny, back when Creation's Grand Slam Convention was still going in Pasadena before they gave it up, and it was still in Pasadena at the Union Center the way it had been all through the 90s. So Von Armstrong is there, and it was right when I was kind of getting to know him. and got to know him pretty well after that. But he was there and signing, and I wound up having some influence enough to bring a news crew over, and he was free. And what actor doesn't want to be, you know, interviewed? So I brought this camera over, and Monica, the PR person for Creation, she was like, "Larry, do you know anybody that would talk to Dan?" I'm like, "Oh, that's good. Oh, here's Vaughn. And I went and I said, I told the camera guys from whatever station, and I said, "And this is Vaughn Armstrong, and he plays Admiral Maxwell Forrest." And Vaughn looks at me and he goes, "What do you mean Maxwell Forrest?" And I said, "That's your first name, Maxwell Forrest." He goes, "Get out of here. What?" And I go, "Yeah, no, it's in the script." He goes, "It is." So this was like the first season had been shot, and because they never use it, you know. He's like, "What?" Right. I go, "No, it's in the pilot script, Maxwell." He goes, "Oh, okay." So, you know, by the time you get to Inner Mirror Darkly and he's Maximilian Forrest in the Mirror Universe and all that, they'd fun. Yeah. Anyway, that's like the first person that let me into Quark's bar in Vegas was Armin in the back door. So that's one of those little moments that I'll – but yeah, so the way things, you know, evolve going forward and all that. The other cool thing, just because I've got a copy of the Bible, the other thing that I thought was really kind of interesting out of the gate was a couple of things about Travis and about Malcolm. Because originally, the buddy-buddy was supposed to be Tripp and Mayweather. They were supposed to be. And Malcolm was supposed to be this odd bird, kind of flaky guy that loved bombs and armory stuff. And got off on the boom. And he was supposed to, and very stiff around women and all of that. I mean, the description here is in the Age of Enlightenment reads a bit of a throwback. He's a 22nd century soldier, all spit and polish and by the book. This is the Bible. He maintains a rigorous daily schedule when he isn't on duty. He's working out in a futuristic exercise apparatus or toiling in the munitions lab, perfecting some new kind of torpedo. He's the antithesis of our chief engineer, Charlie Tucker, who's an undisciplined rebel. The two are frequently at odds. Reed's always trying to expand his weapons inventory, storing ammunition and parts of the ship designed for engineering. Tucker's constantly finding photon grenades cluttering his Jeffries tubes. Reed's filled with death. And then Travis was supposed to be the buddy of Tripp and supposed to be the old space guy. You know, while the rest of the crew was supposed to be the, "Oh my God, look, we're out here and this is where we are," wide-eyed innocence. And even though they were on the sublight ships, Mayweather was supposed to be kind of, despite his young age, supposed to be kind of grounded. And right. And he was Tripp were supposed to be the buddies. And it just turned into one of those things where they got the actors up there and their relative careers and experience and chemistry more than anything else, you know. So it wound up being Travis and Malcolm kind of gravitating toward each other, and the whole thing about Reed being the odd bird, you know, the uncomfortable guy around everybody, much less women, kind of went. And again, another example of some how of that the stayed in evolved. There. Yeah, a little bit. And if you watch the early shows,
Although apparently, you know, he wasn't so bad around women, it seems, because he told Tripp that he knew Ruby, the waitress at the 602 Club, more times than he could remember.
That's what he said in
Shuttle Pod 1.
That's a two-thirds of a season. That's an eternity later, see?
Yeah, but it all happened back in San Francisco, though.
Okay, you're back talking the, Star Trek time, hadn't thought of that not yet. Development yes. time in the... Hart building, Cooper building. Yeah.
Well, I'm curious, Jose, with these changes that Larry's talking about here with characters, and you mentioned earlier about original premises for the show. You've said, at least on the other side of the room, that Enterprise was never your show. Things just didn't settle in for you. Were there elements, those early plans, that maybe if they had gone that way, you would have liked the show better?
I think that
the reality of it, or
well, I can talk a little bit about we're talking about the premiere of it, and we talked a little bit before the show started about the first time I saw Enterprise was at a movie premiere on the Paramount lot, where there's a very nice theater there on the Paramount lot, and they had a bunch of people come in, and we had a big old screening for it. I think it was like the day before it actually broadcast, or maybe a week before. It was right around that time. So it was a big, you know, red carpet affair and very nice. And I remember I sat down and I watched the show, and I'd kind of been, and I don't want to say warned is a bad word. I had been prepped. I had been told kind of what to expect. And everybody who I talked to who was working on the show that I used to know from before all kind of said the same things, like, it's good, but ... You know, compromises were made, you know. So I went and I remember I watched it and I came out and I talked to a few people and everybody's like, so what'd you think? And I said, well, I can't help but have been disappointed that in the opening shot there was a Klingon. I can't help but be disappointed that there's a Vulcan as science officer. I can't help but be disappointed that you gave them phasers in the very first episode. All of these things that I felt should have been metered and felt more paced out throughout sort of an arc of a show, especially a prequel, kind of just got blown out right away. And so, you know, I gave it a couple of more episodes and I was like, oh, and there's a time travel guy. Oh, well, that's great. You know, because that had been such a trope, especially of Brandis. Yeah. So I was like, okay, well, you know, there's some things there that look really interesting and kind of cool, but there's a lot of stuff there that it just feels like the next episode of Next Generation, you know, like another episode in that chain of events when it's supposed to take place so much further beforehand. But it wasn't that I didn't enjoy it. It just wasn't.
Yeah.
It was already kind of familiar on day one. And I, you know, when you're talking about like somewhere in the 400th episode of the Next Generation timeline, so to speak, I didn't want it to feel familiar. I wanted it to feel fresh and new and different. And it was only half that, you know. And I know a lot of people give the opening credits a lot of flack of Enterprise. They are by far my favorite opening credits of any Star Trek series ever. Better than the original. They're better than everything is just better about that. Now, I understand the song's a little jarring and it certainly improved when they removed the song and just kind of kept the lyrical part of it and kept just the music. But that whole thing so encapsulates Star Trek in a way that nothing that I'd ever done before. Yeah. And then to see it kind of not pay off.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything they were promising was in that that title sequence, and it didn't quite pay off. So that's why it was never my favorite Star Trek, because it didn't grab me in the way that I hoped it would kind of right out of the gate. And after having spent a year there and having watched every other Star Trek episode beforehand, you know, I needed to be shooken up in order for it to be really exciting. So, I mean, I drifted in and out, and I've certainly watched it throughout my time, but it wasn't different enough from the previous shows to really make me think that, well, this is something that really commands my attention. It was still good at times, maybe even great at others. I watched the pilot this morning because I wanted to refresh myself with the show. And I probably liked it a little bit more. I'm a little bit more further removed from it now, so maybe I'm not as critical about it. But it still had the same problems when we can get into this as we talk about the show, but when Archer opens up the case and he goes, oh, these are our new guns. I'm like, but no, you just had new guns. You just had new cool guns that I'd never seen before that shot little pellets that glowed and blew up stuff. Those were neat. You were running around with two of them like a gunfighter, and now you're getting phasers. I know what phasers do. I don't need to see them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But that, to me, speaks to probably more so a network.
Right.
Well, wanting the familiar, because it's like, look, we have a new-ish network, and Voyager's doing pretty well for us, but we know its time is over. Because it came from syndication and went over to UPN, and now we want to continue that because it's making money for us. It's a good show that we can, you know, that things can lead out of, you know, to get ratings, and we need it to be familiar. And how do you put on a Star Trek show without phasers? That's inconceivable.
Yeah. And, well, now Voyager, just real quick, Voyager started on UPN. In fact, did it launch
UPN?
Launch.
Okay, you're right.
It launched UPN. The network. It was like, oh, here's our flagship. We're launching UPN with Voyager, our prize golden calf. And I was just thinking, I hadn't put these two dots together. Next Gen and DS9, for all their developmental things, really were allowed, you know, that was TV syndication. Paramount TV was allowed to do that on their own and only had to answer to the stations that they put together for their syndicated, you know, network, quote unquote. And all the boo-ha-ha about and la-di-da about, ooh, we're a network show for Voyager on little UPN, and then Enterprise the same way, you had that layer of network notes. And I'm sorry, but UPN, you know, well, UPN and WB launched out of the gate the same time, and UPN was always the goofy, crippled little guys because their management on both ends was always running around in circles, and Moonves finally jumped in and took it. And that level of network interference hurt Voyager out of the gate. And it hurt Enterprise.
Well,
in all fairness,
I
and I'm glad to see them talking about this on the Blu-rays and things now, because yeah, a lot of people didn't know some of that.
In all fairness, I don't know if how much network interference there was on Voyager. They had earned enough capital on Deep Space. I'm telling you, when I worked there,
the Maquis went vanilla because of
when I went. But that also...
But that's Voyager.
That's Voyager, yeah. Not Enterprise. When I was there, there wasn't a lot of interference on Voyager, per se. There was certainly... the word coming back to me after I left was that there was... The network wanted to be a lot more hands-on with Enterprise than they ever had been on Voyager. There were actual notes on Enterprise, where on Voyager, the time I'd been there, I don't think I'd ever seen...
Well, I'm talking about launching. I'm talking about, yeah.
So I don't think I'd ever seen a network note on that. And as far as the Voyager launch, I don't know. But like I said, the time that I was there, the network and Rick had a very amicable relationship. Mm-hmm. Almost never did I ever hear the words, oh, we got to change this because the network doesn't want it. You know, we got a note from the network. Those were words I never heard.
Right, right. Well, I'm talking about the developmental stage. But anyway.
But definitely Enterprise, I think, suffered a little bit from a network wanting something very, very specific for a very specific reason that it wasn't always motivated by, say, creativity or a love of the franchise, but rather a need to have a show that's pulling in a certain number and a certain demographic at a certain time on our network, which is floundering or not doing as good as we'd like it to be. And
it was only getting to 80% or whatever it was of the country to begin with. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there was definitely some pressure because of that. But let's talk about the episode, and we can talk about that kind of stuff then. But I just, but I remember that. So that was sort of the vibe when I went to that screening, was people were happy that it had turned out so well, and they were excited about certain aspects of the show, the idea of a new ship, of discovering stuff, of that kind of stuff. But too much of the familiar crept in too quickly to make sure everybody was happy. And, you know, and those are the kinds of things that really, you know, turned me off as a fan. I didn't necessarily want it to go like, I know a lot of people's favorite season is the last season where it gets very sort of continuity heavy and very sort of, I don't want to call it fan fiction-y, but Manny really starts pulling at all the threads that are leading into Star Trek, and everybody's like, oh, I see that. I didn't want it to go quite that far, but I did want them to build to moments that they never got a chance to do.
Well,
but,
sure.
You know.
Well,
so,
well, we can talk about that too, but there's two or three specific reasons why that happened. Can I correct one thing I said earlier? Not correct, but kind of say. I was talking about the cornfield where Klang, or whatever his name was. Was it Klang? I always thought that was hysterical. Clag. Anyway, the Klingon crash lands. I was saying corn. It was originally supposed to be corn. That's why they were looking at Iowa and Nebraska. But what they found out was this was May, June, and the only thing that was near L.A. to shoot in, there was no cornfield nearby. They had wheat, and that's why it came south. And then that's why they latched onto the Oklahoma thing as a joke. So yes, in the show, people are like going, they land in a wheat field, Larry, not corn. Yes, I was going with the original thing, but... They landed in wheat, and then they went south for a state, and then Rick latched onto the Klingon from Oklahoma joke, and yeah. So, yes, it was wheat, but still, there was no wheat or corn near, within 5 miles of Broken Bow, but that's all fine. That was pre-war, as Jose said.
Well, Larry, wouldn't you like to have a Klingon from Oklahoma as a linebacker?
I tell you what, yeah. I don't know, Chris, we had a couple of Klingons as linebackers. No, I started to say, I've known some Klingons from Oklahoma. One of them was a police sergeant at Oklahoma City PD. But anyway, that's a fandom story. Well, my perspective on the premiere was, and let me go back to something. I know we want to get to the show, but real quick. I just remember my first instinct, when I first came out like in 92, 93, 94, and I first got to knowing the writers, and I remember Ron Moore, and I remember Rene Echevarria talking about how many good writers at the time, even Next Generation, that's where we started. How many good writers Star Trek had chewed up because you had to work in the box, in the sandbox, in the universe. And how some, like Frank Abbatamarco was one. Some of the guys that you would see come and be 13 weeks and they were Emmy nominees, but it was just hard to do. And they were talking about, the perfect humans of Next Generation and how do you do drama with no conflict and all that and deal with the technology and the canon and the timeline. And I said at the time, well, as a canon person, and since Next Gen opened this can of good worms, you've got all these corners and you've got all these areas of the Trek universe to go to. And I want my canon filled. I want my gaps filled. And I said from day one, answer those concerns. Do a show set at the founding of the Federation, the Romulan War. They're heroic, but they're learning the lessons that Picard and Kirk even take for granted later, the Prime Directive and blah, blah, blah. And technology's not so great that it saves your ass every 5 minutes and all that kind of thing. And I was like rared up to that. And Jose helped me with this. There was a fake screening or there was a fake questionnaire put out somehow quasi-officially about what would you like to, like fans or a test screening or something about what would you like to see as the next Star Trek series? And one of them was like special ops Marines, and one of them was like set at the founding of the Federation Romulan War. And there were like three or four different formats for a show.
You know, and you got me on that one. I've never heard of that.
That came out, and because I was like going, because I thought I knew already that it was going to be a prequel, but I think they were doing it either to throw people off or to really get a gauge. And
well, I just remember
people, this
things.
Whole faction of people griping that it was a sequel out of the gate was just like the people that were griping back in the day about Next Gen. How can you call it Star Trek if it's not Kirk McCoy? That was just like small-minded to me. And there are still people that will say that because Star Trek is about going into the future. And I go, guys, last time I checked, 2161 is in the future.
Right. You know? It's pretty futuristic. It's set in the future.
And a lot of people who weren't happy with Enterprise the way it played out still are unhappy that when they say, see, and I will say, and some of the things Jose was just saying, some of the disappointments, it got too fast, too familiar, too fast. And some of that Manny under his tutelage, it feels a little crammed, but some of the things that people always thought the show was going to be, it finally got to in the fourth season. And I have to say part of that's, shoot me for saying this, but part of that's Brandon and Rick's familiarity with the original series and maybe some of the fanboys who became pro writers over the years running it later on were able to address some of that just in between the lines. But without opening that can of worms, they had the last year to jump on and do all that. But the whole concept of the show itself was not the problem. I think this and there's other prequel times to go back to that still could be the source of a series. You know what I'm saying? But anyway.
Well, talking about story elements themselves, one thing is some people point out in Broken Bow itself, we go to Kronos so quickly. There's a Klingon. Oh. Like you said, Jose, there's a Klingon there in the field right at the beginning of the show. And then we go to Kronos right away. And of course, that's a thing where, you know, the Klingon homeworld was kind of like a mythical, not mythical, but like a mystical thing or something at some point in Star Trek.
The Klingons always had kind of
a name.
Especially when you get into like the movies and TNG, they're almost like a closed society. You don't get to go unless you're one of them.
Yeah. And then suddenly we're there. That's
and you're
the
talking
things-
about a story element. I remember seeing the pilot at the screening and thinking, well, that wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to. It was more like my expectations had gotten so lowered that I was like, well, that's not as bad as I was expecting. And the thing that pissed me off the most wasn't so much that they went to Kronos, but they went in 4 days. Because Kronos was supposed to be, you know, it's like,
right.
That was my canon fanboy moment of like, that was the thing that pissed me. It's like, now how are we going to explain this one? So anyway.
Well, if you bring in the new movies, Larry, you can actually beam to Kronos from Earth. Right. So, you know, it must be really close. It must be over in Pluto or something.
Yeah. Well sure, done, put that sir. One in perspective.
So there was that. There was, of course, the temporal Cold War, the future Gaia element, which we've mentioned here as well. And then the Vulcans, which seem to be, as I talk to people about Enterprise, but it all starts here in Broken Bow. It starts with the scene where they call Archer in because they've got the Klingon there on the medical bed. And you see right away that the Vulcans are really pricks, basically, at this point. And we don't really know what happened because we saw the Vulcans land in First Contact in Bozeman. And this is almost a century later, so this relationship has been building. But we don't know what happened in between. And even the Vulcans that landed in Bozeman, all we know about them is that they're startled by jukeboxes. That's it, you know.
Nice line there, Chris. Yeah. See, and it wasn't so much the way it was in the pilot. It was more as it developed over some of the shows. I think the Vulcans got a lot more prickier as the series went along until the fourth season fixed.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But they're definitely... They're definitely like the parents from the beginning.
Exactly. And I get that. I mean, I thought that was, as a concept, was fine to do. I mean, I think if you look at how the Federation treat people on First Contact, how many people strictly interpreting Prime, I'm sorry, we can't save your, you know, we're going to secretly, we secretly come in and save you from your volcanoes or whatever and your tectonics, or if you're subwarp, or, you know, natives or whatever, or we just let you die or whatever. Oh, please help save our world. I'm sorry, we can't. We have this thing called... You know, so I can kind of see that. And the uber-logical Vulcans... I mean, like, I don't get it that the Vulcans treated anybody else this way. And if it feeds into the fascination with why are humans these backward guys and everybody else is space... Andorians and Tellarites and Vulcans and Klingons and Romulans are all spacefaring and we're the new guys on the block. And yet we're the ones that everybody, like, sets up and take notices of. You know, whatever. And the Romulan War plots we didn't see, but what all the different story writers tend to come into was we were the last guys to move in the neighborhood, but then we started running the neighborhood council, and people liked it. And we did something that nobody else seemed to have been able to do on their own anyway. So all that was fine with me. I just didn't like the way they just got more and more rude and stupid. And then when you have the fix of, well, a lot of this is with Romulan interference, then it's, you know, subterfuge. Then that's cool too. It was a nice fix. But yeah. But did you notice that the Vulcan aide to Gary Graham there was named Toss, which was an odd one, but it was the TOS. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Just to ask, because you guys know Enterprise a little bit more than I do, was that ever actually explained? Because you keep saying about the fix. Was it, I'm asking Chris and Matt, was it explained at some point in time why they were such kind of, well, dicks? And during this time, or did they ever explain, well, this is why they were so sort of openly hostile and almost, you know, like a nun wrapping your fingers, you know, all the time?
No, I don't think they did that, Chris? It just, that episode came along and it was just, oh, that must be the reason why.
I think the closest thing that I can think of to an in-show explanation for it was probably the conversation between Saval and Forrest in the embassy on Vulcan right before the embassy was bombed, the Earth embassy was bombed, where Saval admits to Forrest that Vulcans are kind of scared of humans because we remind them of themselves, their violent nature, but we overcame the devastation of our great war, World War III, in a century, and it took thousands of years for the Vulcans to do it. And so they were kind of scared, I think, of what humans might do once they had warp capability and they were, as Larry said, running the neighborhood council.
Mm-hmm. That's a really nice explanation. I kind of like that.
The Vulcans, as it unravels, are also weirded out by themselves. They're still hung up on mind melding here. You know, the mind melders have been ostracized and all of these little bits that... But it was the Vulcan trilogy, the last season, that kind of fixed a lot of this stuff. They had strayed from Surok's pure teachings, and he had become, you know, gee. I guess, you know, so if you have, like, strict originalists versus constitutional – I mean, Surok fundamentalists, you know, you get into interpretation, and you've gotten off on these whatevers. But, yeah, it helps having Romulan agents in there trying to, you know, not let anyone get out of the starting gate.
I think it was too much of a step back from the Vulcans that we knew in the series that had gone, to come to Enterprise and they're just stonewalled and, no, you can't do that. No, we're not going to give you that. And then to come season four when we were correcting everything, it's just kind of like, well, hang on, there needs to be that, the graying of the area to bleed into what we know of the Vulcans. And it was sort of bang, it has to be, well, it's Romulan subterfuge. That's the answer. And that's the cause of it. And yep. Here we go on to the Vulcans we know.
And I think,
but I guess that was, I mean, the Vulcans weren't the only, that wasn't the only plot thread that we had that sort of just fixed itself in season four, as you said, Larry.
If you'd had that conversation, maybe if there'd been a little self-awareness rather than we're just going along with this mentality, if you'd had that conversation between Forrest and Sovol partway through season one or at least season two, then it would have been like, oh, here's a self-awareness this is an intentional choice, not just because, not just that we kind of got off down this way.
Well, I think you know. They serve, so the, go back to the episode when they're, the big theme of the episode is very much children taking first steps, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just humanity taking first steps, being metaphorical as children and all that, but there's a lot of flashbacks to Archer and his father and making that first journey. So for them to cast the Vulcans as sort of the overprotective parent is not entirely a bad idea. I think it very much, I think it fits their character. I think it fits kind of how they are. I mean, look, Spock was the most condescending person on the Enterprise almost every single episode. He didn't mean to be. He wasn't trying to be arrogant when he did it. It was just that he's supremely confident in his intelligence and in what he knows. And that's sort of a Vulcan trait. I mean, all Vulcan traits are just, you know, sort of, how do you call it? Extrapolations of what Leonard did as Spock. So,
right.
So as a character bit, they work really well. They are good. They're good foils for us as humans. They're good. They bring back some of that Kirk Spock mentality, that emotion versus logic kind of discussion, and it gives us someone to it gives us a reason to root for the humans. It gives us a reason to root for our crew. It gives us a reason to root for humanity, that we're finally ready to take this first step out of the womb. And though you cast them in that light, I understand why people might be upset about that. But they're perfect for that part. They're perfect to be the overprotective parent. I mean, that's all they do, is they walk around and they tell you, yeah, you know, you really shouldn't do that. Like, and what's great, I think the way that they did it was, I think with T'Pau, who came off a lot better in this viewing than I remember her coming off the first time I watched it, was it, they have, she gets to have moments where she's both right and wrong. She gets to have moments where that supreme arrogance is earned and people around her should listen to what she has to say. And yet at the same time, she's never necessarily put in her place, but she has to learn to trust these people at the same time. So, and I thought she really, both as an actress and as a character, all of that really played off really, really well. Like I was a little amazed at how well that worked. And it,
you're talking about
looking at it with latter day eyes.
T'Pol.
What's that?
You're talking about T'Pol, not T'Pau.
Oh, did I say T'Pau? I meant to say T'Pol.
You're still working off of the Bible.
I'm working off the Bible, yes. Did I say T'Pau? I'm sorry. No, the other one.
Because T'Pau does turn up in the series later on.
Yeah, she does, doesn't she? I never saw that episode, but I know that she did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I thought she really, like I said, she really played that. I love the scene. That one of my favorite moments in rewatching the pilot is a scene where the little boy is gasping for air and the mother's weaning him off the respirator and Tripp's freaking out. And she's like, you're, and there needed to be more of this sentiment in this pilot, that this is your first time stepping into the bigger sandbox. Like,
step, I know you're ready, Junior.
It's not step aside. It's, I know you want to run across the street, but you have to look at both ways before you do that. And there needed to be more of those moments where our humanity, our arrogance as humans needs to be tempered, while yet at the same time our sense of adventure is rewarded. And there was too much of, we're awesome humans, and less of,
we're awesome humans that still need to learn a bunch of stuff. And it's in some of the dialogue, but it's never there are moments of that, but not as many as there should be, which kind of make Archer's sort of tacit stay on Enterprise moment a little bit less powerful than it could be.
Jose, I think you would have liked the version of Broken Bow that aired on Vulcan a little bit better, because it was more the we're awesome Vulcans, and they cut out a lot of that awesome human stuff.
Those stupid humans.
And that floating in the Jeffrey Stube scene was gone.
Oh, my God, please. But I really enjoyed, I kept watching it going, boy, they really are kind of prickish, these Vulcans. But the more you get into it, the more it's like that it really is, they are overprotective parents and we are children going out there. And it's and the parallels are drawn throughout the story. So it's like, if you're going to cast somebody in that role, then it should be the Vulcans. It absolutely should be them.
Right. Well, I didn't have a problem. Like I said, I didn't have a problem out of the gate. I just, after a year or so of that and seeing like every single Vulcan is like personally, and until you got, it's like only the odd bird Vulcans, like the Seven. What was the show where they brought the great Vulcan ambassador aboard, and then she turned out to have been booted off with the secret.
Yeah.
It's like you had to have the turncoat Vulcans come out, but they're all like, which kind of in a way led to, well, the turncoats who are being persecuted are the ones that we all think of as mainstream Vulcans later.
Well, I was going to say, isn't it always that the sort of the ones that are that take front the character, the Vulcan characters are the most interesting to us, aren't the ones that are the most Vulcan. They're the ones that break rank. It's Spock's a half human, you know. T'Pol is how do you call it? She's more sympathetic than the other ones are. It's always that it's the odd bird that we're more interested in because they're frankly more interesting than any, you know, if the guy on the council who tells Spock in the movie, you know, the latest movie or the first of the latest movies, you know, that you're expelled or whatever it was that he told him. I forget because it was such a boring scene. But
but it was on an angle.
Yeah, so no, I got it. Dutch tilt and all that. But but he tells him that, and you're just like, well, that guy's boring. We don't care about that guy. We want the outcast. He's the one who's interesting because he's expressing some kind of difference, and that makes him interesting. So when we think about sort of Vulcan tenets, even though they all spur from Leonard's performance, he really isn't the prototypical Vulcan. The prototypical Vulcan is far less interesting than that guy is.
Right. Well, I'm talking about by the time you get to like Andorian Incident or whatever, when they've got the Vulcan assault team with the big honking guns, and you're just like, this is just really a little more, you know, off the end here that I'm thinking the, you know, but anyway.
But they got to have it. You know, that's the thing. That's the kind of thing when I think about some of the races that we've dealt with, and especially the Vulcans, because they've always been in such a box. They've always been in the logic box.
Yeah.
And they're almost monks or priests to a certain extent, because they're supposed to be just so devout in their logic. And yet Spock transfers his soul, so there's got to be some religion there. They've survived wars, therefore they fight. They know the Vulcan neck pinch. Mm-hmm. Spock knows some kind of space judo. You know, I mean, there's more to these people than just the box, and I think it's okay to explore.
It's like there's
that,
more to being Klingon than being warriors. So
exactly, absolutely, yes.
Texture, anyone? Oh my God, yes.
Well, let's talk about another story element in here. And
please,
you mentioned this one earlier, Jose, as well. Future guy, the temporal Cold War, the Sulabine. And I'm curious to know your thoughts on how this played into Broken Bow, because there's so much going on in Broken Bow. You've got the Klingon who's crashed on Earth. They've got to take him back. He's carrying something in his blood, which was always a disappointment for me in this episode, that when they actually get to the chamber on Kronos, the Klingons do the blood sample and they put it in, and then all the Klingons are like, oh my God,
what's because they brought a triple back felt, to life, and then they thought they would apply it to future augments in 4 years.
It felt like that whole thing was just contrived as a reason to get the crew to go to Kronos in the first place more than anything else. But
I think
that's going on. And so in addition to that, you've got this future element going on as well, which seems to be something more the studio is pushing for. Do you feel like there were too many things going on at once here, and did that muddy the waters?
I'll give you two takes on it. I'll address sort of both things separately. I think that the plot is get the Klingon home. That's your pilot. I mean, that's not the story. That's just the plot. And yes, it's a mechanism to get the crew. It doesn't have to be to Kronos. It could have been anywhere. They could have gone anywhere. They could have gone on any mission. But it's about. I think the reason why you end up with Kronos and a Klingon is because someone somewhere decided we should have a Klingon in this episode. It's Star Trek. Yeah, and there should be a Klingon here. But I thought the reveal of the information in his sort of DNA strand, mm-hmm. I thought was really clever for the time. I mean, that's pretty smart stuff there. So his thread was what it was. Again, I wish it had been some different race and, you know, anything but a Klingon, but mm-hmm. that's fine. And then as far as the temporal Cold War, it feels like, and you guys can correct me on this if I'm wrong, but it feels like Enterprise and the idea of a temporal Cold War was really, really that got Crew's first attempt at doing big arc stuff. Except for probably some mm-hmm. Deep Space Nine stuff, but again, that was Ira and a sort of a different kind of thing. Was kind of their first attempt to do this big arc stuff that Star Trek had typically stayed away from. They were always like a one and done, reset the button. We're back at the beginning. Every episode, you can show them out of order. You know, no big deal. So they were trying to lay the seeds of something. In that first episode with the temporal Cold War and all these guys, you know, sort of manipulating time to whatever end it was. And it did feel muddled because I don't think it was done as
they didn't have a plan.
I disagree about the plan thing because that whether or not they had a plan or not is immaterial. Lost didn't have a plan, but they handled that kind of stuff.
Look how that turned
out. I think it shows, though.
Yeah, but for, you know, whatever, 4 or 5 seasons, they handled that far more deftly than Enterprise ever did. You know, so you don't have to have a plan. It's about execution, and I think that the temporal Cold War comes off as a big giant clunker for me. First of all, because it's time travel again, and I was just over it by that point in time, sort of in Trek. And it was handled a little bit clumsily, clunkily. Mm-hmm. They kept cutting to the silhouette talking to the mm-hmm. to the alien, and none of it made any sense. But you're like, why are they in a temporal Cold War? And how is the sort of the resistance of all of this speaking about it so plainly and so matter of factly? Everything just felt like disjointed and. Like, wait, somebody's messing with time and no one's freaking out about it? Like, everybody's just like, what are they talking about? And it all felt very rote and very, you know, matter of fact. Oh, yeah, there's a temporal Cold War going on. Don't worry about it. It's tossed away in a line. And there's no, like, what the hell's going on? So I think it's a little bit of clunkiness in execution. I don't mind the idea of long arc stuff. I mean, that's what most of good TV is these days, is this long arc stuff. I just think that at the time, it wasn't handled very deftly. It should have been better, you know, because you also get the impression when Archer's fighting the head of the bad guys there at the end, that he's the one. The voice sounds similar to the projection, but it's not him. Mm-hmm. But yet he knows all these things about the future, and it was all really, like I said, not handled as well as humanly possible. And because I kind of only dotted in and out after that, I never really, you know, and it never seemed to impact the episodes that I watched. So I was like, okay, you know, no big deal, you know, I think television as a whole learns to do that arc stuff better a little bit further down the line with shows like Buffy and Lost, and we get better at that. I just don't think that at the time people were handled that properly. That's just my two cents on it.
There's a show on at the moment called Person of Interest. I don't know if you guys.
Oh yeah. I work with that show. Yeah, so I know it.
All right. Awesome. Well, you know, but that's the sort of thing, as you say, you know, the TV shows later on have learned better how to deal with long-running arcs, and Person of Interest will throw you in a really standalone episode, and then at the end of it, they'll throw in something which means nothing at that point, six episodes down the track, as they're doing now as they're leading into the season finale.
And it feels...
Everything's coming back.
And at the time when they lay down that... when they lay down that pipe in that episode, you're thinking, oh, that's probably just a one-off thing. You don't really...
That's right.
And then they come back to it later and you're like, oh my God, it pays to be a viewer.
That's what they should have done with Enterprise, because...
Yep. Exactly.
The Blacklist is doing that too.
Yeah, whereas in the temporal...
And the Blacklist
yeah,
as well.
Exactly. Whereas in this temporal Cold War thing that we're getting into, that we got into in this pilot, it's so obviously like... Look, there's a big thing happening, and that's why this weird thing is happening here, where that's fine, but we didn't need that to take up so much time and space in a story that really should only be about taking our first nascent steps into a larger world. And
that's right. And being that pilot episode, it shouldn't have been
right.
This.
It should have
major
that
thing,
that
this
moment
in future guy.
And to fanfic here for a second, that moment should have come at the end of a season or at the end of like 13 episodes, where let Archer have his moment where he's like, nope, you know what? We've been out here a year or however long we've been out here, 6 months, and I've got this. I've got this all figured out. We're good. We're going to make it out here. And then, bam, you hit him with time travel and crazy, abstract concepts that humans haven't even dipped a toe in, and
you
blow him out of the water then.
You have a Q-Who Borg moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the greatest episodes of TNG, is that moment where he's... where Q is basically, you don't understand. Like, it's bad out here. It's really, really bad out here. And you think you've got it figured out, but you don't. And here's why. And he shows him, and it scares Picard to his core. Yeah. And it's a great episode for that. And they could have done so much more with Enterprise, but they didn't. And again, I don't want to cast stones. Everybody's working their hardest to make the best show they can. Just, sometimes you make a mistake. Sometimes you think you're doing the right thing, or you think you're doing it right and it's not working out. But in this case, the temporal Cold War, well, the bad pun is coming. It left me cold. It was just like, I just didn't care.
Well, the temporal Cold War was supposed to be a safety valve. It was like, okay, well, if we jump down a road here, then we can maybe use that to... I mean, it was like we're taking a big risk doing a prequel, so it'll be our, it'll be our plan B or our... Deus Machina or whatever, if we get into trouble. They started the Zindi year 2 years later, not knowing how it would end or even how long it would go. It was just like, we've got to do something here to try to save the show. And they got into it about a fourth of the way through and went, oh, okay, then we can do this and this and this and plot it for a whole year, and it's working, and we can make it tighter and everything. But
it was such a prominent thing to be a safety valve where it was fixed in to the point where you were just expecting that it had to be developed. Whereas on DS9, they would constantly throw things into the stories just so they could pick them up later on if they felt like they needed something.
Or if they wanted to pick them up later on. They throw things out there and they're like, great, we have that. That's a gun hanging on a wall that we can get to a year, 2 years later, and it's still there. We can bring back this character.
Or we can leave it.
Yeah, and you can just leave it there and it just is, Right.
Well, the second season, DS9, they would mention the Dominion about every fourth or fifth show, just dropping it in.
Sure.
I was just going to say, Larry, wasn't the first mention of the Dominion in a Quark comedy episode.
Yeah.
It was just thrown in there as, we can't do this because of the Dominion. And you're like, oh, okay, the Dominion. And then you come to the season two finale, and you're kind of like, oh, my God, the Dominion.
Yep.
Ira just had it right.
Yeah. I feel like I'm beating up on this episode a lot.
No, that's a series thing. It's not an episode.
I don't want to beat it up too much because I really did enjoy a lot of it. And I was struck once again at how much I love that Enterprise. How
gorgeous Enterprise.
What a really nice design that ship is. Just kind of as a techie, nerdy kind of thing. You know, the Enterprise is always sort of the centerpiece of every show, and I looked at it again. I was like, boy, that is a good looking ship. Like, it's not it. They managed to do the thing that you have to do is take the dish and the, you know, the nacelles and the sort of secondary hull and then mix it up a little bit. But just by lowering it a little bit and giving it the original series colors on the nacelles, and it really, really cool. Really cool looking ship.
Well, I mean, it was very controversial at the time, but they were just in love with the Akira and thought that was cool from first contact. And so this.
Well, they were right. The Akira is a cool ship.
Well, I remember there was a lot of attempts at times to try to blend the timeline and have some things look quasi spin out of Botany Bay DY-ish lookingness. And you're going to have like at Terra Nova, they were trying to do the GART guys wanted to do a DY-ish ship and the producers said, it looks like a pencil. And so, no, let's have a saucer and a box and some stuff. But, and then they got a lot of flack. This doesn't look like it evolved in the, you know, we want a more Enterprise-ish looking ship or something that's tied to something we already know is historical. So, I mean, I remember that being almost as controversial as the theme song versus no theme song. But, you know, and then Doug has a plan. And they've done the model kit now of here's Enterprise in 3 and 4 years and after
the refit.
Because I remember, yeah, refit. It does look a little, it looks flimsy to me with that split hull, that P-38, what is it? That Mustang kind of look, which seems, even though you're talking about warp dynamics, but it has a kind of a flimsy look, and to be the first ship launched, that's okay. It would have been funny to call that a dreadnought. I hadn't heard that, Jose, but to call that ship a dreadnought would have been kind of a joke because it didn't look very hulking.
Right.
But the way, did they do a refit of the NXR?
Doug did a refit, not on the show, but Doug did a refit, and it has a secondary hull. It starts looking more like the Enterprise we're familiar with. There's lots of artwork on it, actually, over on Doug's Facebook page.
I'll have to go to Doug's.
Close down the Dregs files, but yeah, it's a nice ship.
But that was part of it too. Was all, you know, the design and the whole thing about we want it to be a. I remember hearing about Herman going down to see a submarine at San Diego, and I'm like, what is that? See, it was interesting to be around the lot and working because you're talking about the overlap of, I mean, you know, the real world effect of this was Brannon stepped away from running Voyager, and Ken Biller show ran the last year, although they were involved, but they were developing this show and all the talk about, you know, this is the amount of detail. This had to be a fresh start, and it had to be a bold statement, and part of that was the look and everything about it, and everybody, like I said, everybody had to go through their paces again, and some design people didn't come back, and everybody else got put to the ringer about, no, this, we cannot be just, you know, same old. We've got to have a shakeup here, and the whole thing of it looking dark and submarine-y, and the whole, you know, the conceptual thing about it being much closer to NASA today than we Kirk's time, which I agree. I thought the credits were wonderful, and you really got that feeling through that. It really, more than any other ones, it's not just pretty ship running through pretty star backgrounds. Right. It's that real sense of here we are, and here's how we, you know, the developmental stills and things. In fact, I went over to the place that did the titles, and we did a thing about how the titles evolved, and they were telling me about stuff that they threw out and how they came to that process. But all that was good. But then I remember, do you remember this was the first year they were on, the show broadcast darker than they filmed it, and everybody was complaining about it, and everybody was like, there was this round robin Thomas Nast thing. It's like, no, it's the distribution network. No, it's UPN. No, it's your DP. No, it's our post. No, it's, and there was this whole consternation about why does the damn show look so, not dark as in DS9 was darker than Next Gen, you know, brightly lit. But
no, I know what you mean.
The gray and the blue. So
yeah, I really thought that's where to talk about the good stuff about this show. I really think that those are the things that I think I wish they had gone deeper into that well, was giving the ship that submarine look, giving them the flight suit uniforms that didn't look super colorful. You know, they look practical and useful. I wish I had done a much deeper dive into that kind of submarine first explorers low tech kind of thing.
Spam in a can.
Yeah, exactly. and relied less on other stuff. You know, it's the transporter moment. They could have saved that transporter moment, you know,
yeah. Yeah.
And in the episode. And again, I don't want to knock on the bad stuff, because those are the kind of things that I think really excited me about the show was oh, they're gonna do all of this stuff, and they're not gonna have all the normal tools in their toolbox. They're not gonna have the universal translator. They're not gonna have, you know, warp 9. They're not gonna have, you know, they're not gonna have a bunch of stuff. They're not gonna have Starfleet. They're not gonna have a Starbase or you know, a refit. They're gonna be out there doing stuff without support, and that to me was very, very, very exciting. They're gonna have every contact was a first contact, and they didn't dive into enough of that to make it different. And I don't want to go back to the Marvel analogy I made earlier, but something that Marvel has learned to do very, very well is, yes, it's all one universe, but Iron Man is a straight up action adventure movie. Captain America has to do more with war and how we feel about America, and especially this one has a very 3 Days of the Condor, French Connection kind of vibe to it. Guardians of the Galaxy is going to be a Star Wars movie, and then Avengers is just, you know, a big, you know, free for all of action. That you can have characters living in the same universe or under the same franchise banner, and yet give them different texture and feel. And I think not enough people on both sides, on both the fan community and on the, I'm going to call it the network side, because I always like to give creators the benefit of the doubt, had enough faith that Star Trek was a strong enough concept to support going outside the box, for lack of a better word, to do something a little bit more different.
Well, we've been going about 20 minutes longer than usual for us here because it's been such an interesting discussion. And actually,
I feel bad that you have to edit this down because there's a lot to edit down.
And I could talk about it for 3 more hours and go fully into the story and all, but I think we should probably start wrapping up here. And those were fantastic. What I would see as final thoughts there on the whole thing there, Jose. So I'm going to ask Matt next what final thoughts you have on Broken Bow and what we talked about here.
I think, yeah, very much that there are a lot of things wrong with it and the whole series. But having said that, it was still Star Trek and it was still that vision. We were exploring what we knew already, but figuring out how we got there. And it was just very unfortunate that there was a lot of meddling, I think is the best word, and working in Australian television, I see it right now. One of our networks here is struggling, and some really good Aussie drama is suffering for that. We've got 2 shows on at the moment that are struggling to reach over 500,000 viewers. They are quality programs with quality actors and quality creatives, but they're not being seen, and the network is trying to make changes to them and probably won't renew them for a third and second season because, well, they didn't rate. And it's just kind of like, well, it's not necessarily the fault of the creatives and the actors and everyone. It's the network. And you put it on that sort of platform. As Larry said, it only reached 80% of the country rather than our syndication with Next Gen and DS9. That Voyager really suffered, and I feel that. You know, but an Enterprise and starting out with Broken Bow and I guess what I'm sort of feeling is that Broken Bow was trying to save UPN, and we all know how that worked out.
Yeah,
couldn't save UPN from itself.
No, well, you know, and that's it, you know. So, but great show, great series, and it got a hell of a lot better. And I had a chat with Connor Trini last weekend when he was over in Perth for Oz Comic Con, and he had no idea what he was getting into. He said, you know, had no idea that it was a trip to Pol Archer. Triad really was the carry of the show. When you have this ensemble cast, and unfortunately they weren't used as well as they could be. But it was still a show just like every other Star Trek. Took a couple of seasons to find its feet, found its feet, gave us some great quality episodes along the way, and And then we ended it with in a holodeck with two characters that had been there for years.
Well, we're not going to talk about that right now, Matt. We'll
no, sorry. Clear that. Sorry.
Well, Larry, what about you? Any final thoughts on
I've got two here? Words for you. The butterfly twins.
The Klimaszewski,
I forget what beer brand they were doing at the same time, but anyway, yeah, they did cons for a while. That was kind of wild. Look, it's the wacky, sexy part here. So yeah, don't leave them out.
All right. Well, thanks for sitting in today and giving us a behind the scenes view, you know, of what was going on and then all the other thoughts here, Larry. Before we let you go, where can people find you, A, and what do you have going on that people need to know about?
LarryNemechek.com, TreklandBlog.com. The Con of Wrath is coming up. I think this will be up pretty quick. I've got a bunch of conventions coming up real fast. So I know you have listeners spanning the globe, Chris. So in short order, I'm going to be at Tampa Away Mission April 11th that weekend, April 12th. The weekend after that at WonderCon here in Anaheim, and then the weekend after that, a new thing for me in Detroit at Midwest Media Expo, and then the end of May at Phoenix Comic Con. That'll be a huge one, and then I'm finally, after about 10 years, going to get back to FedCon in Germany, and then in June at SoonerCon back home, and BayouCon in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and then, of course, we're into Comic-Con in Vegas, which are a week apart, and the Star Trek tour at geeknationtours.com is we are officially made and going to happen. So if you're interested in all that, you've probably heard me blather on before about it, but that's all there. And the Con of Wrath.com, we're planning up to game up there, and that's what's going on right now. Star Trek Continues is going to have the third episode out in the middle of June. And yep. The third one was filmed, and it's been officially said now that it's going to be a mirror episode. So there you go. Salivate, yeah. People.
As soon as we finish recording this today, Larry, I'm going to be editing the show. I have James Carwin, Chris White both on. We recorded last week. Lots of teasers about episode 3.
And there's such teases. I'm sure that you... And Chris, a big South Carolina Gamecock fan, so I have a video of he and I on the night OU and South Carolina both pulled off incredible games. We were shooting Lolani, so that's coming up sometime. So yeah.
I'm feeling outnumbered now. We've got John Van Sitters, South Carolina, Chris White, South Carolina. I have a little bit uncomfortable.
I have enough Sooner Magic Tide. Bluster that I can blow you all away, so it's good.
All right. Well, thanks again, Larry, for your time tonight.
Thanks, guys. It's been fun.
And Jose, what about you? It's great to have you back on the show. I can't believe how long it's been. You mentioned when you were on with Dave Rossi and Larry, and we talked about the state of Star Trek.
I think Doug and I did an episode where we talked about another Enterprise episode. I can't remember which one it was.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we did that too. But we did. Doug brought his Andorian antenna.
Yes, he did. Yes. Yes, I still have that picture. It's a great picture.
It is great. So, where can people find you? And you know, what do you have going on right now?
Aside from, working and all that good stuff that has nothing to do with the public, we do a show every Sunday called the Zero Room. We're actually live on Mondays, sometime on Mondays, usually in the afternoon.
Oh, you do that live? Okay.
We don't do it live. We've been talking about doing it live, but we're not doing it live yet. We record on Sunday nights. It's out on Mondays. It's me and the aforementioned Doug Mirabello. You can find us, on iTunes and, you know, the usual place. It's pop culture, sort of current state of entertainment kind of thing. So we do that every week. And that's pretty much about it. I don't, I like to keep my podcasting light. So one show, come on you guys every once in a while. That's enough. A lot of people don't need to hear me talk all that much. So,
all right. Well, and if people want to find you on Twitter or anywhere?
If you want to find me on Twitter, we have the Zero, we're at the Zero Room, and I'm at Ringslinger, RingSlinger. It's a comic book thing. Don't sweat it. If you want to hit me up there, by all means, go right ahead.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us tonight as well.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, Chris, it's been absolutely fantastic to have a chat to Jose and catch up with Larry again and get their thoughts on Broken Bow. Great discussion, I think.
Yeah, they always have such great behind-the-scenes information. And Larry sent me a message just now, and he said, I don't think you ever want Jose and me on the same show again because they have so much information. They talk and they talk, and we had such a long feature. But no, actually, I do want Larry and Jose on again because it's exactly the kind of stuff that I love to hear and want to share with everyone.
And it helps you because you don't have to script too much. It just happens. And
that's right.
And the episode makes itself. It's wonderful. I know that from that's a creator's right. point of view.
Absolutely. Well, Broken Bow isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this week. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Montgomery Scott.
It's really just their... to tell a story that they couldn't tell with Kirk or Spock or McCoy.
This is true. An episode where Kirk is framed for the murder of a hooker would be...
Right. Awesome.
Completely different.
But...
it would be awesome, but...
Earl Grey.
Ships of TNG Part 2.
Commander Riker, why would you protect the inferior ship? I want its treasure. I want the other ship.
Darren, how long have you been keeping that one in your pocket? You
yeah, I like
tell
that.
Us.
That was good.
Do a Ferengi.
The Ready Room.
Scientific method.
She tells the woman that comes on the bridge, and she's like, "Well, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter to me. I'm going to drive into these stars. It's going to be great." Like it's like I'm just like
the orb.
Till death do us part.
His are very quizzical in nature. They're of the scientist. They're of the somebody who is willing to accept, okay, what is this reality? What's going on? She's just all like, tell me what to do right now. You know, like,
right.
She, there's nothing spiritual about her.
To the journey!
One versus doctor's orders.
I was working full-time on top of being a full-time student, and I...
Listen, I don't want to hear your excuses, okay? I don't want to hear them.
Like, life was happening and...
A great man once told me, if something's important to you, you make the time. Warp 5.
Undeveloped Enterprise stories.
But the idea here is that Porthos would become intelligent and would be the only member of the crew capable of communicating with a canine alien. So even Hoshi apparently couldn't figure out this dog language.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Biff Bull, Chimera.
I'd love to see an X-Files one shot with Scully and the hookers.
With know? Scully and the hookers?
Yeah.
That's a great name for a band.
We can call it Scully and the Hookers.
Melodic Treks.
Five musical favorites.
You know, I don't completely hate the opening theme. I just really think that Archer's theme should be the opening credits.
Continuing mission.
Star Trek Axelar with Alec Peters.
That's what we posit. We say it makes sense that at this point we know it's from TOS. They're not integrated, so our crews are not integrated. And we make a point of that. We don't avoid it. We make a point of it. And in Prelude to Axelar, they talk about that.
Literary Treks.
IDW Alien Spotlight Part 1.
Well, Chris, it's okay because they can see the Romulans from their house.
That's right.
So, from space. You know, you betcha. You know, that's okay. I can see the Romulans from my starship. It's going to be fine.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new shows for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows, and you'll find them in a wide variety of places, including iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, or Zune, or you can download or stream from the website. And as I mentioned in news, go over to iTunes, check out our new home in iTunes, our new site, and all the pages that we have in there, and I hope you'll enjoy finding our shows and past episodes that maybe you haven't heard before through that new portal. Matt, since our last Ready Room, we received some listener feedback from Dante Hopkins from Chicago, and Dante wanted to say thank you for your show on the TNG next-to-next-to-last episode, Emergence. Emergence has always been one of my favorite TNG episodes since it first aired 20 years ago. And he put wow in parentheses, and I know how he feels because I remember watching Emergence. And I was finishing university at that time. I was very near. I think I was a senior in university. So it's hard to believe it's been that long. But Dante says it still remains one of my favorites today, and I'm glad it's one of your favorites too. The moment in the episode where Data says consciousness is an emergent property blows my mind each time I hear it. I once recently learned this episode is largely disliked by most fans, which still confuses me. But I'm glad Darren, Philip, and Daniel all gained at least a better appreciation for this always fascinating episode. Thanks to you and the Earl Grey team for a great chat. Well, I'm off to New Vertiform City. Thanks as always, Dante Hopkins. And Matt, yeah, it's surprising to me too that Emergence, the episode where the Enterprise is coming alive and they've got all those crazy scenes on the train and this new life form is being formed, isn't loved by fans, because I really enjoy it. What do you think about that episode?
I've actually only ever seen that once, but yeah, wow. It was very different, and it was a departure from Next Generation that had come before. And I think that I have to rewatch the episode to double check, but my memory of it was that it was a great episode, and it was you could tell the series was coming to a close, but it wasn't going to fizzle out. It was going to go off with a bang, and you know that it did with such great episodes as that one.
I wonder if people feel that way because it came at the very, very end of the series like that. Like if that had been a fifth season episode, maybe people would have embraced it a little bit more as a holodeck story.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
Maybe so. Well, Dante, thanks so much for your feedback. I'm glad that you enjoyed that episode of the show here on the Ready Room, as well as that episode of The Next Generation. For everyone else, if you'd like to send us feedback on what we've talked about here today, on Broken Bow, anything we've talked about in news, or anything else about Star Trek, you can do that in several ways. You can go to our website, and there's a form there at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website, or you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about the show and about any Star Trek topic that you want to discuss. And then if social media is your thing, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And you'll find us on Twitter, where we're tweeting away about Star Trek all the time under username trekfm. Now, Matt, when you're not sitting around trying to figure out, you know, just how to talk to an Enterprise-era Vulcan without him being a jerk to you, where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter and Facebook as well, TrekZone.org. There's no dot in that, TrekZone.org. And yeah, I'm tweeting away and doing original content there with interviews and the fan series and everything else. And also sitting in the 602 Club trying to work out that conundrum of talking to Enterprise Vulcans. Sometimes you just want to slap them over the back of the head with a face pistol.
Excellent. And so there's no dot in the username there, but there is a dot in the website, correct?
That's right. Yep. TrekZone.org. And don't ask me why it's .org. It's something that came up with 11 years ago now, but yeah, TrekZone.org. And trying to keep things fresh and interesting, doing putting my opinions on episodes, but also sort of making that more of a background sort of thing now and just filling out the website, but doing these interviews and the fan series. And that's the main drive of the site. So keep checking that back, because it's all coming and new stuff is being added every week.
All right. Well, if you would like to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere on social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network, I already mentioned Matthew Rushing a moment ago. Matthew and I do Literary Treks Together, where we talk Star Trek books and comics and we interview authors. And we also do The Orb Together, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine. And if you love Enterprise, check out my show Warp 5, where I talk exclusively about Enterprise every week with different guests, and we dig into the minutiae of the show. And then I have a couple of interview shows. I have one called Matter Stream, where I talk to scientists and creatives and writers and actors about things that are loosely related to Star Trek or inspired by Star Trek. And I have my new show, Continuing Mission, which is all about fan series and independent productions. And I've had some great guests on there already. Doug Drexler, Alec Peters, James Kerwin, Chris White from Star Trek Continues. That episode's coming up. And I've got some other great ones coming up for you as well. So go check out all of those shows if you're interested. Before we let you go, I'd like to remind you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com, the best source for audiobooks online. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible, and you'll be helping us keep the show coming to you at the same time. So go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and grab any book you want, The Klingon Way, which we talked about in news, or anything else. And if at the end of the trial you decide not to stick with Audible, remember, you get to keep that book, so there's nothing to lose. So go check it out. You're going to love Audible and audiobooks, I know. I've been downloading from Audible for 14 years now myself, and so I can definitely speak to the quality of what they're doing, and you're going to love it. So again, go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up, and we really thank Audible for their support of the Ready Room and the network. And there's one more thing you can do if you want to help us keep the show coming to you, and that's to make a donation to the network. Our shows are free for you to download, but they're not free for us to produce, and your support helps us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring everything on the network to you each week. And if you go to trek.fm/donate, you'll find different contribution levels to choose from, and we have some original Alien artwork for you as a thank you, available as badges or art prints. Again, that's at trek.fm/donate, and we really thank you for your support and helping us keep the network going. All right, Matt. Well, it was a really fun show today. I'm glad you could join me. I love having new voices on the air with me each week, and I hope you'll come back soon. But for now, I'm going to wander back down to the council chamber and see if those Klingons can tell me just what was going on in that blood.
It's a mystery, Chris. It's a mystery that'll haunt us for many years to come. Perhaps even into a new series.
Oh, maybe.
You call it Star Trek Blood.
Star Trek colon Blood. I love it.
That's how you got to say it. Well, Chris, it's time to stick a phase pistol in it because the Ready Room is done.